Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with your hosts, Drs. Anish Chagpar, Susan Higgins, and Stephen Gore. Dr. Chagpar is Associate Professor of Surgical Oncology and Director of the Breast Center at Smilow Cancer Hospital. Dr. Higgins is Professor of Therapeutic Radiology and of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences. And Dr. Gore is Director of Hematological Malignancies at Smilow and an expert on myelodysplastic syndromes. Yale Cancer Center Answers features weekly conversations about the research, diagnosis, and treatment of cancer. And if you'd like to join in, you can email your questions and comments to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888-234-4YCC. This week, it's a conversation with Dr. Demetrius Braddock. Dr. Braddock is Associate Professor of Pathology at Yale School of Medicine, and here's Dr. Anish Chagpar.
So, Demetrius, tell me a little bit more about who you are, your background, and what you do in terms of your research.
Oh, sure. So, I'm basically a biochemist and a physician. I trained in biochemistry at University of Chicago, where I went to medical school. And then I followed that with training at the National Institute of Health, where I trained in chemical physics, the structure of molecules and their shapes, and in anatomic pathology. And so currently at Yale, what I do is I diagnose cancer, blood cancers, as a hematopathologist. And my research involved a family of enzymes that were kind of understudied and not really understood. And they catalyze a very interesting biochemical reaction, which is why I was initially interested in them. The reaction they catalyze is the most unfavorable biologic reaction known to man. So this reaction, without the enzyme present, takes one every 1 trillion years. So that reaction will happen once a trillion years, unless the enzyme's present. So depending on your view of the age of the universe, it's never happened before without the enzyme. So we were very interested to understand, you know, what these enzymes did in the body physiologically, what their importance was, because they catalyzed such an unusual reaction. And that's kind of led me into the current direction of our research.
So I guess the first question is, how do you come across an enzyme that catalyzes a reaction that may never have occurred? And how do you get interested in this particular enzyme if the reaction hasn't occurred yet? And how do we know that that's important?
Yeah, so I should state that the reaction occurs all the time in the body because the enzyme is there. So
Okay. The
enzyme takes a reaction that would absolutely never occur without it being present, and it happens several times a second. So it makes it very favorable. And it does that by reducing the free energy of the thermodynamics of the reaction mechanism, which is something we study as biochemists. And organic chemists have been really interested in these reactions for years, probably 50 years. And it's been a fascination of research in the chemistry field. But I think it's really been lost in the biologic field, the importance of these enzymes. And so, that kind of motivated my interest in them, because they're basically, you can think about it, that they're creating a very rare signal that never happens. And so when that signal happens, it's telling the body something really important. Pay attention. This is an important event. And so the body responds to that in big ways. And in the case of one of the enzymes, it causes blood vessels to form and tumors to metastasize. Mm-hmm. In the case of another enzyme, it causes bones to form and calcium to build up or to disappear in your body.
So big, important reactions.
Yeah. So these are like key physiologic regulators of homeostasis in the body. And so this is kind of my theory, is that these enzymes are key signaling events that govern whole organismal physiology. And that's why I started looking at them.
And so you started looking at them, but what does any of that have to do with cancer?
Well, one of the enzymes, the first enzyme really to be fully worked up, which is the second enzyme in the family, and so it's named NPP2 for the number two. This enzyme was originally discovered in melanoma cells because melanoma cells secrete it, and it causes move and metastasize and evolve in the body. And so when I was at the National Institute of Health, my chairman at the time, Lance Liotta, discovered this enzyme, and he introduced me to this family through this enzyme. And then we at Yale, when I got here, we looked at this enzyme, we looked at inhibitors to it, and we showed that small molecule inhibitors can prevent tumor metastasis if you inhibit the enzyme's activity and so forth. And that work has now evolved into drug companies basically developing very sophisticated inhibitors beyond what we were capable of developing. And those inhibitors are currently working their way through the clinical trial process.
Well, that's very cool. So is it just this one enzyme, or are there other enzymes in this family that do equally cool things and that have been equally well worked up?
So NPP2 was the most described and studied because of its role in cancer. And when that field was moving very rapidly and, kind of, I was unable really to chemically keep up with it because I'm not a chemist, I'm a biochemist. I began to look at other family members, and I looked at the less well-studied family members, and that led us into our current research, which is looking at the first family member, NPP1. And this enzyme catalyzes a different reaction, completely different, and it generates an inorganic chemical in the body called pyrophosphate. And we knew that pyrophosphate was important for bone formation, but we really didn't understand how important it was. And that got us into sort of an investigation of what the role of this enzyme may be in the body. And we began to study diseases associated with the enzyme, and we came across a very rare disease in which individuals are born with a mutation in the enzyme, and these babies tragically develop calcifications in their vascular system, and they will die at about 6 months of age because of low levels of pyrophosphate. So that became a very interesting point of research for us.
And so then what happened?
Well, so then we began to really think about how we could take our understanding and knowledge of the enzyme and manipulate, this lethal disease. And we came up with a strategy to deliver the enzyme as a drug, which involves modifying the enzyme so that you can inject it into the body. And we did an experiment where we took mice that have this mutation, the same exact mutation that the humans have, and these mice also get vascular calcifications and they die within 30 days of life. And we treated the mice with the what we call a biologic, which is an enzyme replacement therapy. And we found that all the mice that we treated dramatically recovered from the disease. The enzyme therapy prevented the disease, the vascular calcifications, and they appeared completely normal. Hmm. Whereas the mice that weren't treated all died within 50 days. So it was kind of a black and white dramatic biologic experiment, and something you don't often encounter in science.
And so has this now been translated to humans? I mean, have we tried this in children?
So no, we just finished that experiment, which we call the proof of concept experiment, last year, a year ago. And about this time last year is when we completed that. And so now you go through an FDA approval process where you take this data and toxicology data and additional data that you acquire, and you file a package with the Food and Drug Administration to get what's called an initial new drug application. So this is the current state of this therapy. We feel that this is a metabolic disease, and metabolic diseases are predicted very well in animal models, unlike some cancers where the cancer can be cured in the mice and not in humans in some cases. In the case of metabolic disease, the animal models are actually very accurate for the patients. So given that it's a lethal disease, there is no therapy, there's no good cure. It's a horrible, tragic disease. We are hopeful that we can move this into a clinical trial within 2 to 3 years.
Excellent. So So how common is this in children?
So it's actually very rare, and it's what we would call an ultra-rare disease. So the incidence is 1 in 350,000 is what the estimate is. So one person in 350,000 may come up with this disease. Now, there are kindreds, of patients where, every fourth child they have will have this disease. So if you happen to be an affected individual and you're married to another affected heterozygote, we call it, you may have several babies with this. So it's tragic for those families, and they may have a series of children that are partially or fully affected with this problem. But what we're understanding about this disease is that these babies also get renal failure, and they present, either born with or quickly develop renal failure as well as vascular calcification. And those processes are related, they're interrelated. And it has to do with phosphate balance and the ability of the kidney to excrete phosphate and so forth. And so even though this rare disease is very rare in a very select group of patients, there's a huge group of patients with renal failure. 1 in 10 adults has renal failure. And patients in renal failure also develop vascular calcifications identical histologically to the calcifications in this very rare disease. They have a histologic signature where it's a medial wall, so the calcification occurs in the muscle layer of the artery, and that's very unusual in vascular calcification. So we think that the pathophysiology or the root cause of the disease in this rare instance in babies with this mutation is also the same cause in patients suffering from renal disease and can also be treated with this biologic. So we are pursuing this very common cause. Perhaps 2 million patients a year could benefit from some form of therapy to reduce their vascular calcifications in kidney failure.
So in the renal failure patients, do they also have a deficiency in this enzyme?
That is not known, but we know that the renal failure patients have a low level of pyrophosphate. And pyrophosphate is what the enzyme makes, and it's the only enzyme in the body that makes that chemical. Mm-hmm. So we know that the renal failure patients have low pyrophosphate. We know that it correlates directly with vascular calcifications, and we know that when we give the enzyme, we can raise the pyrophosphate in mice anyway, and we believe we can raise it in humans as well. So we're about as sure as we can be without actually doing that experiment that we can intervene in the process of progressive vascular calcification in a large cohort of patients that have renal failure. And so that's a current long-term goal of the research as well.
Yeah, because, as we talk about this, two things come to mind. The first is that, it seems that for the metabolic disorder in babies, it seems like you've come across the answer in mice, which if you developed this drug, this enzyme, could benefit, albeit a very small population of patients, 1 in 350,000. And so you start thinking about the cost of the research, the cost of drug delivery, and how much that whole process takes in order to help such a very, very small fraction of the population, and whether that would then translate into a extremely expensive medication and whether there's value in that. If there is no benefit in the renal failure patients, or whether if we find that this is actually beneficial for renal failure patients who are fairly ubiquitous, that this may actually be of greater value. We have to take a quick break for a medical minute, but I'll let you respond to that when we come back. So please stay tuned to learn more information about basic research with my guest, Dr. Demetrius Braddock.
This year, over 200,000 Americans will be diagnosed with lung cancer. More than 85% of lung cancer diagnoses are related to smoking, and quitting even after decades of use can significantly reduce your risk of developing lung cancer. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center and at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven, to test innovative new treatments for lung cancer. Advances are being made by utilizing targeted therapies and immunotherapies. The BATTLE-2 trial at Yale aims to learn if a drug or combination of drugs based on personal biomarkers can help to control non-small cell lung cancer. This has been a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center and Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Anish Chagpar, and I'm joined tonight by my guest, Dr. Demetrius Braddock. We're talking about his latest research and clinical applications. He was telling us, for those of you who were with us right before the break, about his fascination with an enzyme or a series of enzymes, and one in particular that catalyzes a reaction that, if not present, results in infants dying. But it's so rare. Only 1 in 350,000 births are affected. So, Demetrius, before the break, the question that I left you with was, how is it feasible? Walk us through kind of the steps of the basic research all the way to getting a drug to market, which presumably takes many, many years, not to mention many, many thousands or millions of dollars. And how does that all work in terms of a cost equation ultimately to patients when a disease is, as you called it, ultra rare?
Sure. So just taking the first bite of that question, you know, whenever you think about drug development, you have to be very aware of the potential indications. And this is actually something that when I started at Yale 10 years ago, and I have a long-term interest in drug development, I didn't fully appreciate. So as we talked about, I was initially interested in an enzyme that was important for tumor metastasis. And through conversations with oncologists at Yale, Mario Snoll, who's at Yale, who specializes in melanoma, who was very instrumental in shaping my thinking, I really came to understand that it was almost impossible to take an anti-metastatic drug through a clinical trial process because of the cost associated with completing that trial. It was just too much money, and companies just couldn't do it. And instead, the better indications to look for are very lethal conditions that are very severe. And these conditions don't necessarily need to be common conditions. They can be ultra rare. But if you can get a patient population that has them and that suffers from these conditions and treat them effectively with that drug, that becomes a financially doable problem for a drug company or a development company. And once you get into the patients and you show its efficacy in this rare disease, you can then move into these more common diseases for indications that you would have never been able to develop that drug for in the first place. So for example, we were talking about this very rare disease of vascular calcification in infants, and really some of the perhaps philosophical barriers to spending a lot of time and money to develop a drug for these patients. They're very rare. Now, if you go on websites and there are blogs and websites of these children, it's heartbreaking to see those children die slowly, and it's a tragedy for those patients. So we clearly want to intervene in those diseases for those people, and we're committed to doing that. But it has an additional benefit to the larger society as a whole, because millions of people suffer from a form of vascular calcification associated with renal failure, and we believe that these patients will also benefit from the identical therapy. So you can develop a strategy of drug development where you go into a clinical trial for a limited number of patients, maybe only 10 or a dozen patients because it's a lethal disease, because this disease is very severe and death comes very quickly to these unfortunate patients, you can get through that clinical trial in a defined period of time, which is extremely important when you're trying to develop what's called proof of concept for that indication. So the expense required by investors, by the venture capital community, is the community that will ultimately decide whether the drug gets developed or not, is limited. The exposure's limited. They know that they can spend $15, $20, $30 million, get it through 10 patients, and know if they have an answer at that time. So that's a risk that is doable to a venture community, and that's a risk worth taking, especially when you have on the back end this very large condition that may benefit. But to go into a renal failure population, the clinical trial may be years, and the cost associated with that clinical trial will be exponentially greater. So that would be a daunting initial indication for drug development for venture communities and for companies. So you have to keep in your head as a translational scientist, where you really desire to move therapy forward, you have to keep in your head both the scientific aspects of what you're developing, but also the business aspects of what you're developing. Because effectively, if it's going to be developed, it has to be developed by a business. And these were aspects that I think clinicians such as yourself, Mario, and Dr. Kluger helped me understand when I was a young investigator here at Yale looking at melanoma.
So I want to tackle a few of the issues that you brought up. The first is, clearly, when you see these kids dying, anybody would want to intervene. Anybody would want to develop a drug that could be very effective. And certainly your preliminary data have shown that is very effective. And so a couple of questions. The first is, given the rarity of the disease, how would you actually do the clinical trial, even to get 10 patients? When it's 1 in 350,000, wouldn't that take a national, international, collaborative venture to even get that kind of a clinical trial off the ground?
Yes, I think the answer is yes. But fortunately, a lot of these rare diseases have what we call advocacy networks that are associated with them. So these are networks that are developed by usually the parents of children who have died of these diseases, and they're very committed individuals, and they develop what's called a registry where other affected parents sign up, and they record the progress of the child. All of the medical records are taken, and they're accumulated so that one can access these registries and have a very clean idea of the natural history of the disease in humans. And this is very important when one moves into the FDA to present this data to them, to convince them to allow for dosing and how you design the clinical trial. It can cut years off the clinical trial. So most of these rare diseases will have some form of advocacy network, and it's very important to plug into that. The other essential resource we have in this country is the National Institutes of Health, where I trained, and there's a rare disease program there. And there are physicians who specialize in this disease and this family of diseases. And they have families and patients that they see that travel to Bethesda to be treated. And so one can tap into that network when one develops a therapy for a rare disease and use those resources, governmental resources that have been invested wisely by our government to speed the clinical trial and to accumulate these patients. So even though it is a national and international endeavor to accumulate the patients in diseases such as this that are lethal and very severe. It's not a daunting process. It's a doable process.
Because presumably people travel to those small areas that have the expertise in those rare diseases.
Exactly. And that's why there's such an interest right now in the drug development community on rare diseases generally, is that, you know, it's been demonstrated that even for these very rare diseases, one in 100,000, one in 200, 300,000, it's not insurmountable. It's a very achievable, if it's done correctly and wisely, it's very achievable to enroll that trial within a limited period of time.
What happens to people who don't have the resources to fly to Bethesda?
I believe that the costs associated with all of that, the transportation and the care, is covered by the government. So if there is a clinical trial ongoing, you know, at the NIH, they pay for the transport, they pay for all the medical care, and they cover it fully.
Yeah, so that certainly does help. The next question, of course, is, okay, so you do this clinical trial, and let's suppose that it works.
Yeah.
And we now have a drug that in clinical trials has been found to save these babies. When that drug goes to market with the indication of the very specific indication of such a rare disease, wouldn't the cost of the drug for that indication, given the fact that we now don't have the indication for the renal failure, which could presumably help millions of patients, wouldn't the cost of the drug be astronomical?
So the cost of the drug is really set by the industry, and the idea is to recover the cost of drug development. So for these very rare diseases where not much drug is going to be shipped, the cost is quite high. And this has been in the news a lot recently with some strategy of some pharmaceutical companies buying old drugs that are essentially off patent and then raising the cost of the drug by 100-fold to make it profitable. This is not the situation when you're developing novel therapies that require a huge investment in time and money. But typically the cost of these drugs is quite high. However, once that drug gets into the system and is approved for use in humans, physicians can use it in what's called an off-label use and use it for other indications. And that off-label use may lead to further, more common uses of the drug. And this will in turn drive the price of the drug down, because as it's used more commonly, the price comes down in accordance with the amount of drug shipped, essentially. So you know, in this particular instance with GACI, you may develop a drug that at first is extremely expensive but life-saving, and then the price of that drug may plummet over time if it has if it's found to have efficacy in common indications such as renal failure.
All right. So just for our listeners who might not know what GACI is, can you elaborate?
Sure. GACI is called General Arterialized Calcification of Infancy, and we just call it GACI to shorten that very long diagnosis. And it is what it sounds like. It's a disease that develops in babies where they develop vascular calcifications that harden their arteries, and they develop renal failure and heart failure and eventually expire, usually around 6 months of age.
Dr. Demetrius Braddock is Associate Professor of Pathology at Yale School of Medicine. We invite you to share your questions and comments. You can send them to canceranswers@yale.edu, or you can leave a voicemail message at 888 888- 234-4YCC. And as an additional resource, archived programs are available in both audio and written form at yalecancercenter.org. We'd like to thank the Yale Cancer Center for providing production support for this program, and we'd also like to thank Renee Gaudette, Emily Fenton, and the staff of the Yale Broadcast and Media Center. I'm Bruce Barber, hoping you'll join us again next Sunday evening at 6 for another edition of Yale Cancer Center Answers here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.